welcome to the Science Allies podcast, a product of the Alliance for Science conversation with our global ecosystem of scientists, communicators, decision makers, and activists, all working to build resilience and better futures for communities around the world. Welcome to a new episode of Science Allies Podcast, a podcast of the Alliance for Science based at the Boyce Thompson Institute right here on the Cornell campus, beautiful Ithaca in the middle of summer. So I'm here with Professor Ronnie Kaufman, and he is a legend in food sciences, and I'm really excited that he is able to give us some time to talk about his legendary career and really many of the other things that perhaps you wouldn't know about him, the intangible things that actually help to plant the seeds of institutions on the continent of Africa and in Asia, and also help to nurture scientists who are now coming into full stature as he's coming into the end of his career. So I'm so thrilled to welcome him. I'm so happy that he graciously gave us the time. So welcome, Ronnie.
Good to be here, Sheila.
So before we head in, I want you to talk a little about your career. You have the kind of career that when I read it, I was like, this is a classic. If I grew up to be a scientist, I would want to be this type of scientist. I would want to do everything that you have done. So perhaps you talk us through how you managed to get to where you are today.
Well, just to be honest, I feel very fortunate to, I grew up on a small farm in Kentucky. My parents, they told me you have to go to college, but they didn't really know what the opportunities were. They had exposure to the county extension agent and teachers, so they thought, one or the other would be a good career for me. So, and I didn't have that much exposure either, so I elected the teacher route and started out as a math major. But I needed money. Tuition was only $42 a semester, but I didn't have it. Mm-hmm. And so I just was fortunate enough to get a job with a plant breeder for 90 cents an hour. And I enjoyed it. I mean, a lot of the things that I had to do, taking care of plots and so forth, just came naturally from my farm experience. I knew how to operate machinery and so forth. So I said, I think I'll change my major. So I did. I changed to an undergraduate major in agronomy. And then, to be honest, that was the time when I might have taken a job after the end of my undergraduate days, but the Vietnam War was going on. Mm-hmm. And I disagreed with that, And so if you kept studying, you didn't have to go. So I did a master's degree at the University of Kentucky, and then my professor said, you should go on for a PhD, which I had never imagined I would do. Mm-hmm. So he suggested Nebraska, but I was a member of Alpha Zeta, the agricultural honorary, and we had a meeting in Cornell, a national meeting. So I visited Nebraska. I had visited Cornell in August, which is, kind of a pleasant time here. And I visited Nebraska in February. So I decided, I think I'll go to Cornell. And so I was accepted, somewhat to my surprise. And then, you know, very early on, one of the faculty members, who was an international professor in plant breeding, Loy Crowder, came to me and said, you know, how would you like to do your thesis research in Mexico with Norman Borlaug? Well, I did. Of course, he's the only Nobel laureate in agriculture. At that time, he had not won the Nobel Prize, but he was quite famous. I said, "Well, I would love to do that." He said, "Well, it'll take a year longer." I said, "Well, that's all right. The war's still going on, you know." So I did that. And while I was doing my thesis research in Mexico with Borlaug, he won the Nobel Prize. I was in the field with him when he received it.
Wow.
And I've often told the story. Maybe you would like to hear it.
Yes, please. I haven't heard it.
How it happened. Well, we were out in the field working F2 populations, early generation populations, selecting plants, several of us, including Borlaug. He traveled a lot, but he managed to be around at the right time for selection. So we see a car coming down through the field in the Toluca Valley of Mexico, and Borlaug says, "That looks like Margaret." Margaret was his wife. But she'd never been out there before, so he was surprised to see her. And she didn't know her way around, so she came down the wrong side of a big, wide irrigation ditch. And Borlaug was standing there with his hands on his hips, looking at her, wondering what was happening. And she gets out of the car. She's about 100 meters away. She says, "Norman, you won the Nobel Prize." And so, he walks over to the ditch and they shouted each other for, three or four minutes about it. He's not convinced it was true. He thinks she's the victim of a hoax. And so she leaves, sort of disgusted that he doesn't believe her. And he comes back and we start back to work. And then in about 30 minutes, a reporter from the Associated Press arrives. So that's when Borlaug and all of us knew it was true. But it's just one reporter. And so he and Borlaug talked for, 15, 20 minutes. And then a whole army of reporters and TV crews. So there's actually a movie of it. NBC News had a camera crew that came out from Mexico City. It turned out that first reporter had met a farmer down the road, and he said, "Where is Dr. Borlaug working?" And the farmer told him, "Is over there in the experimental field where we were." And the reporter gave the man 50 pesos and said, "If anybody else asks you, send them down that road over there." So that's what happened, and this reporter got all of his information, and he headed back to Mexico City to file his story while the rest of the people were turning around and getting oriented. So anyway, from I would have taken a job breeding wheat, but some things never changed. There was not much money available, so I was offered a job breeding rice. In the Philippines. I was back here writing my thesis, and the director of the International Rice Research Institute, which was Robert Chandler, the founding director, came in and just said, "How would you like to work for Erie?" I said, "Well, I might like to." But I had, agreed with the Ford Foundation to take a postdoc in Brazil. He said, "Well, suppose I fix that." I said, "Well, I would consider." So he did fix it, and I took the job in the Philippines. And breeding rice is just like breeding wheat, really, except you have to walk in the mud. So it took me a while to get used to the mud and to wading into the rice paddies. But after that, I did what I learned from Borlaug in Mexico, and it went well, and after 10 years, I came back to Cornell as a full professor, and I've been here ever since for the last 40 years as an international professor of plant breeding.
Wow, that's extraordinary. But I think you're downplaying your personal qualities. You make it seem very much like, right, I just happen to be in the right place at the right time, but clearly it's never that. You happen to be the right man in the right place at the right time. There's also that.
Well, I did work hard. Yeah. I'll admit that. And, you know, that's what I learned from my father and mother growing up. So I do. I give other people a lot of credit for where I'm at. And I think that's truly the case. Many other people who maybe work just as hard have not been so fortunate. So I feel very fortunate, actually.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Yeah. So now I want to talk a little bit about the crops that you're most passionate about. How I first knew about your work is around the Wheat Rust Initiative here and the extraordinary consortium or network of scientists all around the world doing this kind of work. It's grand, you know. So I'd like to talk a little bit about your work in wheat and also what you're doing with Next Gen Cassava.
Sure. So wheat, well, you know, Borlaug was an outstanding plant breeder. I mean, he revolutionized wheat breeding. He set up what we called a shuttle. He did it because he was actually trained as a plant pathologist. Mm. And he was very keen in the early stages of his career to get rust-resistant wheat. That was the reason the Rockefeller Foundation sent him to Mexico. Mm. So, you know, he wasn't satisfied to just grow one crop a year. Mm. He wanted to accelerate the breeding. So he hit on the idea of growing the main crop in northwestern Mexico in the state of Sonora, and then taking it to the hills around Mexico City, which was high and cool in the summer, and get another crop there. The plant breeders told him, you know, that will never work. It won't be adapted to your main geography. Mm-hmm. You're wasting your time. But what happened was, you know, it was widely adapted. Mm-hmm. It turned out that it was then insensitive to photoperiod. Mm-hmm. It could be moved from Mexico to North India, mm-hmm. and it was productive in around the world in wheat growing regions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he was successful in developing the rust resistance, and it lasted for some 30 years. Mm-hmm. But in 1999, it broke. Mm-hmm. And he was still alive, and he and I were still in touch. And he was so concerned about it. Mm-hmm. He was approaching 90 at the time. Wow. He was so concerned about it. I said, well, Norm, I'll write a proposal if you will submit it. We'll submit it in your name, and maybe we'll get some money to do something about this, because it's a global crisis. Mm-hmm. So we did that, and the Gates Foundation, even though wheat is not really their thing, mm-hmm. as you and I have discussed before, mm-hmm. You know, they agreed, mm-hmm. really because it was Dr. Borlaug.
Yeah.
And so we said, well, you know, this thing is a problem that has no borders. Mm. We've got to mobilize the global community, which we did. You know, labs from Australia, India, Europe, Africa, Canada, the U.S., South America, the whole global wheat community, and it was a very successful effort.
Yeah.
The Gates Foundation was impressed with that, and they the first award was $26 million, I believe, mm-hmm. and then they renewed it for $40 million, mm-hmm. and then they said after four more years, well, you know, we'd like to expand this concept to delivering not just rust resistance, but delivering genetic gain. Mm-hmm. So we agreed to do that. and they gave us, I believe it was 35 more million. Mm-hmm. So it was a great success due to the hard work of so many people,
yeah,
really.
It was about 1,000 scientists, isn't it?
I don't know if it's that many, but a large number, yeah. At least 500 yeah. or 600 or so would show up at our project meetings. We invited, a few of them got resources from key stations in the world, but we invited everybody to participate, and that was the Borlaug Global Rust Initiative. And we, if necessary, subsidized our participation, especially mm-hmm. together for mm-hmm. meetings. And mm-hmm. they drew on the resources of their mm-hmm. national programs. Mm-hmm. So we had a global research community that was very productive, and everyone was tremendously enthusiastic about it. I hope that we can... Borlaug used to say it's important to keep the herd together, he would say,
Yes.
And it's true. If that kind of community is allowed to dissipate, there'll come a time in another 10, 15, mm-hmm. 20 years, a new race of rust will materialize, and we won't be ready for it, or some other crisis will come. Meanwhile, we're faced with a kind of comprehensive crisis of climate change,
yes.
which needs the input of the global research community.
That's the thing, bringing communities together, building trust, understanding different ways of working across cultures. It must have been very hard then. It's probably a little easier now because we have more technology, more tools. We're more used to talking to each other across the globe. So really, this is actually the time to add more resources to that kind of initiative and amplify it, because it could actually exponentially, those communities could have way more impact than they even did then.
Right. And the key is letting the real stakeholders lead.
Yeah.
And if you're talking about sub-Saharan Africa, the real stakeholders are the folks in sub-Saharan Africa, right? So you mentioned the cassava story,
yes.
next-gen cassava. Well, the Gates Foundation knew they wanted to do something about cassava. Mm-hmm. And they saw what we had accomplished with wheat. And so Catherine Kahn said to me, Ronnie, can you please help us do it for cassava? So we did. We looked at the global community. We invited them to London, and we talked about it. We identified leadership in Africa, and and we brought the latest science to bear, genomic selection. We mobilized key people here in Boyce Thompson Institute and Cornell, as interfacing with the research community in Africa, and the rest is history. It's been, I think, the Bill and Melinda Gates said that the NextGen Cassava Project is one of the five things that make them optimistic about the future of Africa.
Absolutely. And I hadn't really encountered the scientists working on there until I first came to Cornell and met the young, wonderful African from Kenya and Nigeria, women doing world-class, extraordinary work using technologies that people are only just reading about. I was so proud.
Right.
And just seeing just a few of them around the table, seeing the ease with which they are using these tools for these lines of inquiry and how empowered they are in taking it along their own lines. I was just extremely heartened and very encouraged about the future
for
Africa.
My strategy was to have them interview you because
I thought
if we have a chance of attracting Sheila to this job, it'll be her seeing those young people
it
and
really was.
How enthusiastic they are.
It really was. And there was one moment during that lunch where one of the young ladies from Nigeria says, have you got any promising strain? She says, yes, we have one and it's called Obasanjo. I said, Obasanjo, a strong man. She said, yes, it's a very strong strain. I was like, that is fantastic.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's really great.
Yeah.
So now, just to wrap up this podcast, even though I'm enjoying it so much, I want to come to what I have begun to know is associated with you. Of course, you're a world-class scientist and all of that, but anybody who I talk to and I mention Ronnie, they tell me some story about how you mentored and encouraged and opened a doorway and a pathway for their career, especially women. And I know that you've won prizes for that. And I know you're too humble to say anything about it, so I would I would like to mention the prizes. So I think in 2013 you won a prize about the work you did for women, mentoring women.
I did win a prize specifically for that. Sarah Evangel nominated me from the American Society of Agronomy. For mentoring young women. 2013 was the World Agriculture Prize, which was for that and other accomplishments, I guess. But, you know, I don't know. For me, I'll tell you a little story. When I came back to Cornell as a faculty member and I became department chair, and then the dean asked me to serve as the associate dean for research. So I did that job for a while as best I could, and the dean asked the department chairs to evaluate me and in the job. And so he was busy, so he got all those evaluations and he just handed them all over to me. They, I suppose, thought it would be confidential, you know. So one of them said, "Well, Ronnie doesn't do very much. He just chooses good people." So I thought, you know, that's a really backhanded compliment. I appreciated that. I remember it ever since. And I take some pride in that. You are my latest example of that. You're doing a wonderful job.
Thank you.
In the Alliance for Science. And you know, I've always tried to stay engaged. I worked as a rice breeder with an older plant breeder by the name of Hank Beachel. Mm-hmm. He won the World Food Prize. He did for rice what Borlaug did for wheat. He developed the semi-dwarf. Mm-hmm. And he said to me as soon after us, he said, "Ronnie, I want to work closely with you." He said, "I always make it a point to work with young people. That's the only place I learn anything." I was young then, you know. I was 27.
Wow.
And he was 65. But I've always remembered that. It's true. Mm-hmm. You know, you should always keep your relationships with young people because they are the future. So, you know, I thank you for the compliment. I've done a fair amount of that, but there's a selfish part of it too. You know, it does me good to interface with young people and stay up to date with what they're thinking and what are the latest technologies. But I'm also have been convinced for most of my career that women have, you know, not been treated fairly. Mm-hmm. And society has suffered as a result, and it's especially true in Africa.
Yeah.
You know, where women are the farmers by and large,
yeah.
And we should have more female scientists providing, you know, the technology because they have a better understanding of what women need.
Yeah.
it particularly came out with cassava. You know cassava, you yeah. know Africa, you know the finer
yeah.
points of how cassava is
processed
into
garri,
and all of these
yeah.
things. And it's the women
yeah.
who understand that.
Yeah, backbreaking work, yeah.
Yeah, so that's been another, you know, driver in my life, is to see that more women are brought. I was instrumental in getting the first female chair into the plant breeding department when I was associate dean. Mm-hmm. Now we're, I'd say, in our college as a whole, we're probably about 50-50 now.
Wow, really?
Yeah, but that wasn't always true,
no.
You know, and I've seen a change in my 40-year career, and I've done my best to contribute to it, and I think it's been successful.
So, thank you so much. Your success lives on, your legacy lives on, and what you've managed to do without making it explicit or hard is institutionalize your values just by your being. And I think that's the most powerful, powerful way of teaching, that your being is so much that it transforms people to want to emulate you. So I want to thank you for being who you are, what you have modeled, and the legacy you've left in everybody that I've met that has been with you. I've only just met you, and I'm already feeling the transformational effect. I'm so grateful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Sheila, and thank you for being the director of the Alliance for Science. I am so optimistic about the future of the organization.
You've been listening to the Science Allies podcast. If you enjoyed this, or if it sparked any questions, get in touch. You can reach us on any of our social media platforms. And please think about joining one of our communities. Follow the link in our show notes, and you can subscribe to our newsletter and other products. Don't forget to like and share these products too. See you next time.